I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The fallout from the leaked draft opinion calling for the end of Roe v. Wade is being felt inside and outside the U.S. Supreme Court. Written by Justice Alito and signed by four of the other conservative justices, it says that Roe was egregiously wrong from the start and that legislatures should determine abortion laws within their states. Chief Justice John Roberts called the leak an affront to the court, a betrayal of the confidence of the court, and has called for an investigation. CNN's legal analyst Joan Biskupic has been covering the U.S. Supreme Court for years. She wrote a biography of the Chief Justice titled The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of John Roberts. Last week wrote about the lengths the court goes to operate in secrecy. She's also currently working on a group portrait of the nine justices and the pressure of Trump on the Supreme Court due out next year. Joan Biskupic, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You know, it's clear that the leak has intensified the debate about abortion outside of the court. What about inside of the court? What's been the impact?
It is so strong and monumental for this point in the country and this point among the nine justices. You know, when you think about what this opinion proposes to do, roll back half a century of privacy rights and women reproductive rights, we're not sure exactly what stage it's in. And the justices have been negotiating that. The draft was dated February 10th. It was obviously released the first week in May last week. And we do not know what happened between February 10th and that release date and what's going to happen going forward. Just before it came out, my own reporting indicated that Chief Justice John Roberts had been desperately trying to pick off a justice or two from that majority, from the majority that would completely reverse Roe v. Wade. And what the chief wanted was more of a compromise ruling that would uphold the Mississippi law that's in dispute right now, which would ban abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Even doing that would be big, Marty, because Roe v. Wade and the 1992 Planned Parenthood versus Casey had set a kind of a firewall of sorts of about 23 weeks before government could interfere with a woman's choice to end a pregnancy. So bringing back the date at which the government could interfere was already going to be a big deal. But to completely overturn Roe, obviously, would be even more so. But my reporting suggested that the chief hadn't been making any headway. But what I would have said and still say today, what's going to happen at all over the next, 2 months? The ruling would come out at the end of June. So there's just a lot going on. And tomorrow, Marty, for the first time, the justices will be meeting just in private, just the nine, to consider pending cases, but also to try to take stock of what has happened here.
Can we say that the Chief Justice has lost control of the court?
I think we can, and I think we can say it in two respects. First, on the law, the chief still is in the majority and prevailing on things like religion rights, race, campaign finance issues. There are many, many areas of the law where Chief Justice John Roberts is in sync with his fellow conservatives. But on this case and other cases in which the conservatives on the right wing want to go further on the law, he has tried to hold them back. And if this Alito opinion stands, and there are the five most conservative members of this bench, all Republican appointees, three appointees of Donald Trump, are able to do that and change the law so radically in America, he will have lost them on that part of the law. The other thing that he has lost control of is the operations of the court. There has been a major breakdown. Now, he has referred to a single bad apple. He made that reference in a speech last week. He's talked about a betrayal of trust, but we actually don't know how this happened. We don't know if there was sloppiness inside the court. We do not know if a justice or one of the clerks could have possibly had a hand in the disclosure here. I personally can't imagine it came from one of the nine justices or one of the law clerks purposefully, but we don't know. And the fact that I presume he doesn't exactly know right yet, but whatever caused this to happen, whatever got that document in the hands of Politico to be publicized in this way, it definitely reveals a breakdown. And he is Chief Justice of the United States and someone who oversees the operations of that building.
How will an investigation go into effect, though? He has called for the court's marshal to oversee the investigation. Do they have the tools to be able to do that?
I don't think they have the tools inside the court right now. Now, they might get lucky. Somebody might come forward and say, I did it, or John did it, or, somehow they might be able to figure it out easily. And that would be great, because it would end the mystery, at least on that whole part of this story. There would still be a really consequential mystery of how will this case actually come out, which will have much more of an impact on our audience and all of America right now. But the marshal is tasked with running the internal police force, and she's the one that calls "Oye, Oye," at the start of the session. It's not a deep investigative job, and I've wondered if the chief would rely on any outsiders. He has not said that. He's also obviously not using the Department of Justice, which he wouldn't. I don't think he would want to use the Department of Justice, Marty, only because he would probably want to protect the third branch here. Now, if he suspects he knows who has done this, and if any crime has been committed, and that's even questionable in and of itself, maybe then he would call and ask for help with the Department of Justice. But right now, internally, this is not a group of people that are accustomed to going through phone records, going through emails, interviewing people, and I presume all the justices would want to cooperate, but how much will their own emails and communications be delved into?
A question I will just let hang out there. Can we assume, though, that there are other than draft opinions that have been written and are circulating at the court? They weren't leaked, but that this is part of the process of coming up with a decision?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have been watching this court long enough and know enough about the process to understand that a February 10th draft has already been revised in one way or another. Because let's just say, for purposes of argument, because we do not know how widely circulated that draft was inside the court yet, and we also don't know how many justices have responded to it, asked Samuel Alito for changes to it. But normally what happens is the justice who has the majority at that point and who has been assigned to write the opinion for the court would write such a document and then distribute it to his colleagues. Now, the stamp at the top suggested it was distributed to all the colleagues, but, we just don't know exactly what has happened yet. But let's just say it had been. Back in mid-February, the justices in the majority, which would presumably be Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, would have responded to him, given him feedback, and said, I think this is too strong here, or I want you to add this. Meanwhile, the justices in the dissent for that part, which presumably would have been the chief, along with liberals Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Stephen Breyer, would be responding in some way, and they'd be writing their own document to try to counter it, to say exactly what some of those liberal justices have said. Do you really want to turn your back on this much precedent? Our entire jurisprudential scheme is set on the notion of precedent, that no matter how much the justices change, that Americans can count on at least some fundamentals. And what the court said in 1992 of the 1973 Roe v. Wade opinion was we as justices might not have voted the way the 1973 court did. We might not think that it was correct, but it has been so much a part of American society and people have relied on it so much, we are not going to roll it back now. And that's the whole principle that's known as stare decisis, which is regard for precedent. And I'm sure the liberal justices would have been arguing that it would undermine public confidence in the court and the rule of law to write to have a document as sweeping as the one that we saw from the Politico disclosure out there and changing everything in America.
Well, it really was an unprecedented leak because of the size of the leak and the scope of the leak. But you have written, Joan Biskupic, about the secrecy on the court. We know there are no cameras in the court. You can hear audio arguments. Clerks are sworn to secrecy. Documents are shredded. Does this leak then shed some spotlight on how the court works and the level of secrecy?
Yes, and Marty, the court is very secret in two key ways that affect all of us. There is a real lack of transparency up there. The justices will often issue orders in the middle of the night without any rationale about why they're deciding a case one way or another. The justices, conceal a lot of their deliberations not just on, the merits of cases, but how many votes are required for certain actions. There are all sorts of things that they should bring some more sunlight to. That's one whole area where they just don't want to tell you much about how they operate or even their off-bench activities. Some justices will keep the news media from their public speeches. They don't allow any kind of taping. They just don't like people to sort of watch them when they're acting, presumably in the public interest. But in terms of the private deliberations, and the reason I talk about this leak as being so unprecedented is that at times when we've found out other information about cases, and some people will refer to the fact that days before Roe v. Wade itself was issued, someone knew the outcome, but that's the outcome. That's not this early stage where it's clearly a draft document. So that's what's so stunning about this. But that part, the private deliberations, I actually think should be private, because then it means that it's sort of a negotiating tool and a starting point for persuasion. Let's just say some of the liberals might have been able to make some headway with just for purposes of argument, newest justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, two people who seem to have hedged a touch on some of the far-right agenda items. What if the chief or Elena Kagan had been able to start to convince them that maybe this isn't right at this time to go so far against privacy rights in America? What does this do to that, to have it all so public? So that's why I say it changes the calculations inside and out.
Well, we have to leave it there, and I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. I know how busy you have been. Joan Biskupic, thanks so much for joining us and getting our conversation started.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. CNN's legal analyst, and again, she's been covering the U.S. Supreme Court for decades now. We're going to take a very short break, and we've got two guests waiting in the wings to carry on this conversation, talking about the leak document leaked last Monday evening, and it's been all over the news and raising a whole host of questions about the U.S. Supreme Court. We always want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. It's been a week since a leak of a draft opinion signed by five of the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative justices calling for overturning Roe v. Wade, and the controversy has not died down. In fact, it's only heated up. A recent CBS News poll shows majority support, 64%, for keeping Roe. Meanwhile, public opinion about the highest court has been falling in recent years. A C-SPAN poll found that less than 40% of Americans believe the court is nonpartisan. The nomination process, the increased use of the so-called shadow docket, the high level of secrecy, and concerns about ethical lapses have raised some questions about the independence and fairness of the U.S. Supreme Court. We will continue our conversation, the examination of the state of the Supreme Court, the secrecy under which it operates, and increasing questions about its legitimacy. And we have two guests who have joined us. Here sitting across from you, me in our Philadelphia studios, is Craig Green, professor of law at Temple University, and he worked in the Office of Solicitor General. Craig, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Love the show. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us as well. Leah Littman joins us. She's assistant professor at the University of Michigan Law School, co-host of Strict Scrutiny, and she clerked under Justice Anthony Kennedy. And Leah Littman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
Leah, let me begin with you. Since you worked for one of the justices, Anthony Kennedy, I'm just curious about your response to the leak and I guess the reaction to the leak.
I mean, the leak itself is unprecedented. To my knowledge, no draft opinion of the Supreme Court has ever leaked before the Supreme Court has released the final official version. So this is the first time this has ever happened in the court's history. But the substance of the draft opinion that leaked is also quite stunning. Yeah. Even after the oral argument in December in this case, when it seemed as though five of the conservative justices were inclined to outright overrule Roe versus Wade, to see it on paper, in writing, and in such strident, absolute terms was quite striking.
Do you, Craig, did this leaked draft, does it hurt the court? Does it help the public better understand the workings of the court? Was it done, in a sense, for a public service so that all of us can understand a little bit about how this rather mysterious branch of government operates?
Yeah, I think the court is in crisis, and I think that the leak makes things that much worse for both of the reasons Leah mentioned. I think that if you imagine any deliberation collegial body, so it could be national security or it could be a family meeting or it could be even politicians behind closed doors, it's really important to have that kind of negotiation, deliberation, collegial discussion. And that's been the way the court has worked for, you know, its entire history. And this leak, I think I have to disagree a little bit with Joan. I think this leak wasn't by accident. I think when you have Chief Justice Roberts talking about betrayal, I think there's a real image that this did not happen sort of, dropped by the lunch counter or something like this. And then I think there are only really two candidates. One of them's clerks and one of them's justices. Hmm. And if it was a clerk, then they betrayed their boss and they betrayed their oath and they betrayed their institution. But I really think it also might be a justice. And if you think of the lasting consequences of having one of your colleagues betray one of these drafts, I think that could wreak irrevocable damage on the court as a collegial institution and its ability to function atop the judicial system.
Leah, you were a clerk for Justice Kennedy, and I'm, I guess, asking you to get inside a court where you no longer work, but nonetheless, the implications for what Craig just said.
I think it must be extremely tense and difficult at the court right now, particularly if no one really knows where the leak came from and there is skepticism and suspicion among the different justices and between the different law clerks. I think it's probably a very difficult environment to work in right now when you don't know exactly who you can trust because this leak happened.
But Leah, do you think, I mean, is there a need for all the secrecy that the court seems to operate under now?
I think there is good reason for some secrecy and not good reason for others. So I think Joan is right that leaking a draft opinion seems to take the justices' private negotiations into the public eye in a way that could be harmful to the justices' ability to make compromise, persuade one another, and keep an open mind until the opinion is actually final. It's not uncommon for the final opinion to look quite different from the first draft. It's not uncommon for justices to change their votes after an opinion has been circulated or after votes were initially cast at conference. And by leaking and putting out in the public eye a not yet final opinion, it's possible that the leak will deter that process and make it more difficult for the justices to change their minds in big ways and small. But in other ways, I think the secrecy of the court is misplaced. So Joan mentioned that some of the justices have been giving private speeches in which they're not open to the public, not open to the press. I think that that very much damages the institution and integrity of the court, because it looks like a bunch of people just talking behind closed doors to their friends and sharing information with them that isn't available to the public. And I think that that's very harmful to the institution.
Well, let me pick up, Craig, with something I was talking with Joan about. And then I do want to play some clips here about the role of the Chief Justice. He's called the Chief Justice. I mean, how much power does he have if it looks like he's no longer with the majority?
Yeah, I think that just as you folks were talking about, you and Joan, you know, there is a legal side and also an institutional side. And I think that, you know, they call courts by the Chief Justice's name, the Roberts Court, the Rehnquist Court, and so forth. And I think Chief Justice Roberts imagined himself as a leader of a court that would be above politics, rising above politics. And I think that on the substantive area, and this is what Leah was also saying, let's not forget the substance of this opinion is a radical, dramatic departure in a conservative direction beyond what anyone could have reasonably expected for year two of this court, which I think is very, very early. But I think on the institutional side, I mean, this court looks to be diving into politics as opposed to rising above. Mm. And I think that you can see that both with the leak and also with these private speeches, and often in front of partisan organizations, and also the substance of where the court, not including Roberts, where the court's headed.
Would you say that Roberts has stayed, you know, where he has always been, but that the court has gone right?
I think, well, certainly that. And I think these appointments are the key. So, for example, of course, no one can forget the pivotal moment was succeeding Ruth Bader Ginsburg with Amy Coney Barrett, which created a 6-3 conservative majority for the first time in anyone's lifetime, producing the most substantively conservative court since the 30s and maybe before. That is not where Chief Justice Roberts thought he was going to be when he became Chief Justice in 2006.
And Leah, I was talking with Craig about this before going on the air. Former President Trump got three justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. When's the last time a president was able to do that?
It's been a while, and to do so in one term is quite stunning. And it's important to remember that this was enabled by Senator Mitch McConnell, who blockaded, you know, President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, and refused to hold a hearing during the last 9 months of President Obama's term, and then turned around, and then the 8 weeks before, you know, an election, while an election was already underway, confirmed Justice Amy Coney Barrett to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat, even after millions of votes, even while millions of votes had already been cast in the presidential election that would eventually put President Trump out of office. And so it was in large part enabled and facilitated by the Republican Party playing hardball when it comes to the federal court, something that they have been doing for a very long time, and something that the Democrats have not yet responded in kind.
And would you say that's the most egregious example of the politicization of the U.S. Supreme Court, Leah?
I think by far, during President Trump's term and at the end of President Obama's term, what the Republican Senate did took the judicial confirmation and nomination battles to another level, refusing to hold a hearing for a qualified nominee, where, you know, a president attempted to nominate someone who would be seen as a moderate and had been supported by people from both political parties, and then to turn around and confirm someone to a seat while an election was already underway is quite striking. And you add to that, you know, Republicans' behavior during the confirmation hearings for Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, during which they were basically screaming at her about culture war issues that have nothing to do with her, refused to engage with her record, mischaracterized it, smeared her. And I think it's definitely the case that the judicial confirmation and nomination battles have proceeded to another level.
And that's Leah Lipman. She's University of Michigan law professor. Craig Green is with us as well, Temple University law professor, talking about the U.S. Supreme Court for all the obvious reasons. Let me just give you a chance, Craig, to weigh in on just this nomination process. And I do want to play a montage of some of the candidates talking. But your thoughts about, and I'm thinking of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, but also some of the other nominees and what they went through.
Yeah, Leah's exactly right. And I don't say that just because I was a clerk for Merrick Garland back in the day. But rather, I think the other thing to add is that all the things she described about the nomination process have coincided with what everyone knows as a broader politicization of many more issues, attacks on the neutrality of science, attacks on medicine, history, all these sorts of things. And law has been dragged into that kind of same political vortex. And you can see it playing out with the nomination process, which then infect and affect justices on the court.
Well, let me play a montage. It's about a minute, 15 seconds. This is Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett responding to questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee about their views on abortion, Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and precedent. And this is during their confirmation hearings in 2017, 2018, and 2020, respectively.
It is a precedent of the United States Supreme Court. It was reaffirmed in Casey in 1992 and in several other cases. So a good judge will consider it as precedent of the United States Supreme Court, worthy as treatment of precedent like any other.
As a judge, it is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. By it, I mean Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Been reaffirmed many times. Casey is precedent on precedent, which itself is an important factor to remember. And I understand the significance of the issue, the jurisprudential issue, and I understand the significance as best I can. I always try, and I do here, of the real world effects of that decision, as I try to do of all the decisions of my court and of the Supreme Court.
Senator, I completely understand why you are asking the question, but again, I can't pre-commit or say, yes, I'm going in with some agenda, because I'm not. I don't have any agenda. I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come.
Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from ATP: the justices lied and obfuscated at their confirmation hearings about their plans for Roe. A tweet from Drew: SCOTUS nominees lie, hide their real intentions at Supreme Court, at Senate hearings. The court has no trust or standing anymore. It's a political being. Leah, let me toss this back to you. And, you know, what are we to make of the fact that these three now justices said we're going to stand with precedent, and Roe is precedent?
Well, if you listen to what they say, they just are reciting the facts, namely that Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey are precedents of the Supreme Court and are entitled to the weight the precedents receive. But all that means is that a justice will decide, given the factors that justices consider when deciding whether to overrule precedent, the doctrine of stare decisis, that that's what a justice will do if the issue gets to them about whether to overrule those cases. They never said we're not going to overrule those cases. They never said they wouldn't. Instead, they just recited the facts, namely these are precedent, and as a justice, I would consider, you know, the various factors that justices consider when evaluating precedent. And the thing is everyone knew their views, right, even though they didn't have to say them. And so once they were confirmed to the Supreme Court, then all of a sudden the states know, well, now we can ask the courts to overrule Roe. The justices never had to say as much during their confirmation hearings. The fact is they were selected by the Federalist Society and a Republican Party that promised to appoint justices who would overrule Roe versus Wade. And so once they were on the court, then states understood, well, now is the time when we can ask the courts to overrule Roe versus Wade. When Mississippi originally asked the Supreme Court to hear this case that is currently pending before the court, before Justice Ginsburg passed away, that is when the Chief Justice was still the median justice on the court, they didn't ask the court to overrule Roe versus Wade. They only changed their tune and asked the court to overrule Roe once Justice Barrett was confirmed to replace Justice Ginsburg. And the point is that the justices didn't have to say, yes, go ahead, ask me to overrule Roe. I'll do that during their confirmation hearings. Everyone knew their views without them having to say it.
You want to weigh in on this? And I'm also thinking of Robert Bork. And this was back, of course, several decades. But nonetheless, the feeling is that he told the truth and he didn't get the job.
Yeah, I think the confirmation hearing process has a long history back to Bork, or, of course, Republicans would want to compare Brett Kavanaugh's hearing to Judge soon-to-be Justice Jackson's hearing. But I think the tweets really point up an even bigger issue about the relationship of law and politics and courts and politicians. And, you know, one of the ideas of why law is because it lasts. And the idea is it's stare decisis and it doesn't change. Or if it does change, it changes in response to national values. And if it does so gradually over time. And throughout my adult life, swing justices like Justice Kennedy and like Justice O'Connor before him They had a very incremental idea about changing precedent. So one might think, of course, more conservative justices put in place, they would do more conservative things, but they would do it gradually. And this is what I meant to mention before. The idea that this kind of opinion would happen so quickly out of the gates in a case that did not require such a dramatic departure from Roe, I think that is the thing that really signals this is a different kind of court, a different kind of institution, producing a different kind of law. So, of course, again, Leah's right about people expected Roe to take a serious a battering under this new set of justices. Totally predictable. But this kind of way, I think, puts the court in a different kind of crisis position.
Leah, assuming what we read in the draft document is pretty close to what they're going to rule on, at the end of this term, if it goes back to the states, then do we then just we're going to see a patchwork of laws depending on where people live?
I think at a minimum, we will see a patchwork of laws governing abortion access. You know, some states have announced that they are ready and willing to enforce complete and total bans on abortion. Other states have trigger laws, laws that would go into effect prohibiting abortion in the event that Roe is overruled. Other states might try to protect abortion access. But I think further down the road, you know, we've already seen Republican legislators, including Senator Mitch McConnell, suggest that they are open to the possibility of enacting a nationwide abortion ban if and when they control both houses of Congress and the presidency. And I think that that possibility is very much a real one. And if the Supreme Court overrules Roe, I think the next time that Republicans control both houses of Congress and the presidency, there will be considerable pressure on them to enact a nationwide abortion ban.
Craig, I'm looking at a headline. A bill classifying abortion as homicide is advanced by Louisiana lawmakers. Are we going to see then in some states the criminalization of abortion? And by that, I mean that women would get arrested and be put in prison because they got an abortion?
I think that's beyond a possibility. My home state is South Carolina. There are a number of states where the politics run in exactly that direction for substantive reasons and for symbolic reasons. Maybe even as interesting is, of course, I think New York today is considering various laws to try to protect people who might come to New York from out of state and thereby shelter them from criminal jurisdiction in their home state. These kinds of fights between state laws, pros and cons, I mean, I'm a legal historian. I haven't seen stuff like that since the days of slavery, when some states were trying to protect slavery in other states and other states were trying to renounce and rescind slavery even in other states. And so I think that's the, in some ways, when you can't have an agreement, of course, if we do an agreement about Congress, then they might pass a statute codifying Roe v. Wade or codifying fetal personhood. But in a world where the Congress can't agree, the nation can't agree on issues of abortion, you might get these increasingly strident disagreements among states and struggles over federalism.
And that's Craig Green. He's a law professor at Temple University. Leah Lipman is with us as well, law professor at the University of Michigan. We're talking about that released, that draft document, which is poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the leaked draft opinion that could overturn Roe v. Wade, how it has shaken confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court. We're talking about some of the inner workings of the court, partisan politics. We will talk about potential for reforms. And again, our guests are Leah Lipman. She's a University of Michigan law professor, and Craig Green, Temple University law professor. Let me play another clip, and this is during the arguments over the Mississippi abortion case, which was argued in December of last year. Justice Sonia Sotomayor warned the Supreme Court that there was an increasing, quote unquote, stench of politicization.
Now, the sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices. The newest ban that Mississippi has put in place, the 6-week ban, the Senate sponsor said we're doing it because we have new justices on the Supreme Court. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
Leah, Craig mentioned this earlier, but I mean, to use the justice's use of the word stench, will the Supreme Court survive this?
I think that there's no doubt that the public's perception of the Supreme Court is rapidly changing, and for good reason. It's not just this draft opinion. This draft opinion that leaked is one symptom of a larger problem that has included, you know, Justice Thomas participating in cases in which his wife potentially has an interest or could be implicated. It includes the justices appearing at openly political events, being photographed with Senate candidates. It includes the justices speaking to closed door events of organizations and societies, you know, that they are friendly with and aren't generally open to the public and the press. It includes the Supreme Court deciding a slew of cases, often dividing along partisan ideological lines on the shadow docket without even issuing a reasoned decision. So I think Justice Sotomayor is right that the Supreme Court is not doing any favors for itself. It is making itself look political. It is acting in a way that makes it difficult for the public to trust and respect it.
Well, and how do you reform the Supreme Court?
Craig? Yeah, I think rather than thinking of reform, it's almost a question of restoration. So this isn't the first time the court has been in political hot water. In Bush v. Gore, they essentially decided an election, and many of us at that time were concerned the court might never recover that kind of impartiality. And, you know, part of this, I've said again, is in a broader context of politicization of culture and facts and science and health. But part of it is self-inflicted wounds. And when you have Sotomayor saying stench, Justice Thomas earlier referred to the court as a three-wheeled car that's still somehow ran. Barrett saying we're not partisan hacks, and Breyer saying we're not junior league politicians. These people are protesting too much. But these are justices who will control their own fate to a large degree. They have cases on the docket considering abortion and guns. Next year, they'll consider affirmative action. The more that the court on substantive issues, this is a point was raised earlier, on substantive issues makes dramatic, radical change that directly corresponds with new justices on the court, that can't help but damage public perception. There's no way to fix that.
Well, who are they beholden to?
Yeah, I think that it's a little more complicated than that, because you have the Federalist Society and President Trump and Mitch McConnell dedicated to putting very conservative justices on the court. They succeed through a number of fortuities. And then those really conservative justices, presumably for their earnest beliefs about the Constitution, go forth and do really radical conservative things. However, in the past, where it was a 5-4 court for decades, there were doctrines and ideas about incrementalism and gradual change. And what we're seeing is what happens to a court that kicks those things over at the worst possible time. When the rest of the country is divided about so many things, the court has no chance to rise above these political issues. They really do seem to be diving to the bottom.
Lee, you mentioned the shadow docket. Help us understand how that works.
So the shadow docket refers to those matters that the Supreme Court decides without oral argument, without full briefing, and sometimes without any opinion whatsoever. And so in a series of cases, the court halted several public health measures that were designed to contain the spread of the coronavirus on religious liberty grounds. And sometimes the court did so without even issuing an opinion, often dividing along ideological lines. And those cases represented, you know, new and different usages of the shadow docket. You know, previously, the shadow docket was available for something like true emergencies, not whenever the Supreme Court thought that a lower court got an issue wrong. If a lower court got an issue wrong, then typically the case would make its way up to the Supreme Court in the ordinary course. The court would grant, you know, review in the case, hear oral arguments, schedule full briefing and all of the things. But during the Trump administration, you know, the increasingly conservative Supreme Court decided to just start putting on hold lower court decisions with which it disagreed, oftentimes not even saying why it disagreed with them. And I think that that, too, has contributed to a perception that the justices are engaged in politics and influenced by, you know, political thinking about these issues.
Here's an email from Joyce. I'll put this to you, Craig. She says, should Obama have tried to seat Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court without a Senate hearing or vote? Would that have happened? I mean, you know, Mitch McConnell absolutely blocked him, and he had, what, 9 months left on his term.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution requires Senate advice and consent, so there's no way to really cut the Senate out of the process probably. Now, President Obama, and of course I had strong opinions about Judge Garland at the time, but President Obama tried for an up-the-middle centrist nominee to the Supreme Court, which I think actually a number of Democratic nominees have been exactly that. And by comparison, and Leah referred to this earlier, a set of conservative and Republican judicially focused politicians and activists and communities have really made right-wing judges and justices a high priority, not a low priority, in their political agenda. It's one of the main reasons Trump was elected, was because he thought he could deliver on the court, and indeed he did.
And did.
Exactly so. Let me just say one thing about the shadow docket, and I think that's an interesting, important point. You know, after Brown v. Board of Education desegregated schools, there were a number of unsigned, unexplained opinions about golf courses and about public facilities that weren't education. And so I actually don't have a huge problem with the idea of opinionless decisions per se. I think that the thing that's really troublesome about the shadow docket is they are part of the real docket, which is part of this dramatic shift and change. So the real problem to me, it's even maybe worse or better whether you think they do it without an opinion, or they do it with a really big opinion, like the leaked opinion, that explains all the extremely radical conservative ideas that support those kinds of things. So we, of course, there was a case about OSHA where the court wrote an opinion, and it wasn't much better off because I think it signaled the same kind of dramatic judicial aggression, would have been called judicial activism by conservatives of the past. And I think it's just a new world for that sort of judicial thinking.
But Leah, do you think the Republicans, the Federalist Society, just have outflanked the Democrats in whatever, you know, more liberal judicial organization is on their side, just outflanked them, out-politicized them?
I mean, they've outflanked them on several respects. One is that the nominees that the Republicans are putting up are much further to the right than any of the nominees, including in the Biden administration, are putting up, are to the left. I mean, the Biden administration has nominated several public defenders. They have not nominated people who are litigating for reproductive rights and justice, for civil rights organizations, advocating for LGBTQ causes, whereas the right has been putting up individuals who have sought to litigate in favor of abortion restrictions, against transgender rights, against LGBTQ rights, and so on and so forth. So they are putting up asymmetric nominees. And the Republicans have also outflanked the left as far as having an organization that is actually a centralized organization that identifies, you know, the most extreme ideological and motivated individuals to put on the bench. There is no analog on the left to the Federal Society. There is no single organization that is tasked nationwide with identifying prospective judicial candidates for a Democratic administration. Instead, you have Democratic administrations consulting with a bunch of different organizations, but there is no centralized pipeline to identify, you know, the most ideological, most extreme, most motivated individuals on the left for judicial nominations.
Let me play one more clip. This is Republican Senator Susan Collins explaining during Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation process, this is in 2018, that he had assured her that Roe v. Wade was settled law. Let's give it a listen.
We talked about whether he considered Roe to be settled law. He said that he agreed with what Justice Roberts said at his nomination hearing, in which he said that it was settled law. We had a very good, thorough discussion about that issue and many others.
I mean, Craig, also outflanking members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, including a Republican.
If one takes Senator Collins at her word, then I guess that's right. But Senator Collins is a very intelligent, capable person, has been for a long time. I think there's no chance that she was naive enough to think that Roe v. Wade wouldn't change, that Casey wouldn't change. The thing that she might have believed, because it's been true for 50 years, is that those changes would happen gradually over time, and there would be a chance to have public discussion and so forth. The way to think about this leak from a political point of view is it shows what happens when the court veers radically to the right outside the mainstream of national values. And for some number of folks in this country and some number of folks on the court, that's cause for celebration. But for most of the country and for the legal profession and legal culture and perhaps the court as an institution, it's a cause for lament.
Well, speaking of celebration, we have a listener comment. We need to acknowledge there are many people in this country with the point of view that abortion is wrong. We believe life begins at conception. And Leah, I will put that to you. And maybe there's an argument to be made that looking at public opinion, then let elected representatives at the state level decide what abortion should be within their state.
Well, two things. You know, one is that even though people have different views on this issue, it is the case that Roe versus Wade, you know, is a precedent. It's been a precedent for 50 years now. And it is a precedent because, you know, the court has recognized that there are certain unenumerated rights, rights that aren't explicitly mentioned in the text of the Constitution, that are protected by the Constitution because they are so important to an individual's personhood, their autonomy, and their bodily integrity. And Roe versus Wade fit within that line of precedence. You know, there are people who disagree about whether individuals should be able to use birth control. There are people who disagree about whether individuals should be able to marry someone of the same sex. There are individuals who disagree that people should be able to have consensual sexual relationships with a person of the same sex. But those are all decisions that connect so intimately to who an individual is, their destiny, their autonomy, their identity, that the court has recognized that they fall within the zone of interests that are protected by the constitutional right to privacy. And even if you think those cases are wrongly decided, they are also cases around which people have structured their lives. And that is part of why those decisions are entitled to precedential respect. The other thing that I would say is, you know, returning these issues to the states is not returning them to democracy. Because of voter suppression, because of gerrymandering, and because of a host of other things, voter discrimination, state legislatures are not perfect democracies. And so instead, we are returning the issues to extremely gerrymandered state legislatures that now have a green light to engage in voter suppression and voter discrimination, and they are not enacting policies that actually do reflect majority will.
Craig, picking up on what Leah was saying about LGBTQ rights, about birth control, and other issues related to privacy, if Roe is dismantled or essentially disappears, do those rights disappear as well?
I think that is the radical element that we've been referring to, all of us, about the Alito opinion, is although he says this opinion is just about abortion and just about Roe, actually the implications are exactly what Leah describes. I could add one more. Forced sterilization is in that same line of precedence. And I think the idea that individual states would be able to roll back contraception law or ban same-sex marriage or force sterilizations, these are the kind of things that I think would strike most Americans as radical and almost unbelievable. But they are the logical conclusions of this kind of fulsome and extremely full-throated attack on privacy rights and autonomy rights and liberty rights that, again, have been absolutely established, yes, fought around the margins, but this entire renunciation of that whole approach in favor of 16th century, 17th century, 18th century law, that's really dramatic. Now, the court's going to have a lot of other cases to show us whether, in fact, they're the radical court people fear they might become with the kind of opinion that this Alito opinion suggests they might be, or can they, will they turn toward a more, we could call Chief Justice Roberts, incrementalist approach that spreads decisions across times and makes the court seem more like a legal institution than a political one? I think that's the next chapter.
Well, Leah, we're almost out of time here, but Craig talked about, quoting, and this is an Alito's opinion, people from 15th, 16th, 17th, I think even 13th century. What did you make of his argument? And he did quote a lot of people that were, almost from medieval times.
This has been the method that the justices have used and that some of the justices have been pushing for to decide these fundamental rights cases. And it's very concerning because the justices are relying on the views of people who sentenced women to death for witchcraft, the views of people who argued that marital rape was not a crime. And it should be very concerning to everyone that a majority of the justices are apparently open to the idea that rights have to be deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition. And if women didn't actually enjoy any rights that are deeply rooted in history and tradition, then are we not going to have any rights at all? It's just one of the many radical things that was evident in Justice Alito's draft opinion.
And Craig, we're almost out of time here, but we'll be waiting then for the final decision. I assume that'll be the end of June sometime. What do you think is going on in the court right now?
I mean, I think that's right. And I can't give an unbiased perspective because my whole life has been dominated by justices like Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor. They've been the swing votes. That's what I was taught a court should do. That's what I thought a court was supposed to function in a democracy with political actors. It's almost unbelievable to me that five justices would join an opinion like Alito's, but we are told to believe that that's the truth. And by the end of June, we will really have the clearest signal there could be about what anyone should expect from the Supreme Court for the next 10 to 15 years, which is the likelihood until someone like Justice Thomas could even theoretically be replaced by someone else and change the composition of the courts for people who don't believe like this.
We got to leave it there. Craig Green, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Professor of Law at Temple University, Leah Lippman, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Assistant professor at the University of Michigan Law School, also co-host of Strict Scrutiny, and I should add that she clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy. Our guest, Craig Green, worked in the Solicitor General's Office. Clearly, I'm not a lawyer. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.